the headlines. Iranians hold nationwide parades on wheels to mark the 42nd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran's foreign minister warns the U.S. that the window for taking a new approach regarding the 2015 nuclear deal is closing. And the Yemeni army says it has hit the airfields of Saudi warplanes at Abha International Airport with several drones. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mias. Thanks for joining us. Iranians have celebrated the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. People in different cities and towns turned out en masse, but in their cars or on motorcycles. They did so to observe social distancing because of the pandemic. In previous years, nationwide rallies were held to celebrate the Islamic Revolution in Iran. The revolution emerged victorious on February 11, 1979. On that day, the Iranian people toppled the monarchical rule of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. The revolution was led by the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini. He established a new political system based on the principles of Islam.
Iran is celebrating the 42nd anniversary of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That's an event which marks the Iranian people's overthrow of the Western-backed Shah's regime and their victory against Western powers, most notably the United States and Britain. During the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took to the streets in their millions to take control of their destiny and of their country's natural resources. But what has the landmark event brought to the Iranian nation in the first place? Facts and figures indicate that the Islamic Republic has been making long strides in a whole variety of fields. Defense-wise, thanks to the nation's resistance and steadfastness, Iran currently has one of the strongest militaries in the world, with Forbes ranking the Islamic Republic the fourth of their top 10 lists of strongest West Asian militaries in 2019. In the field of science, most particularly medicine and health, a 2009 report by the World Bank shows that the Islamic Republic has achieved a significant growth and enormous improvements. Based on that report, Iran ranked 21st in terms of quality and number of hospitals. In 2017, the country ranked second in the world in containing contagious diseases. Iran ranks fourth in the world in terms of production of nanoscience technology and seventh and ninth in biotechnology and aerospace industry, respectively. But given all the advancements Iran has made during its 42 years of existence, the question arises as to why the West, especially the United States, continues with its failed strategy toward the Islamic Republic.
The USA, plus its partners in the European Union or Europe, have never been happy with the situation in Iran, and they have made all kinds of efforts, whether it was an eight-year war, whether it's economic sanctions, or whether Iran is to be cut off from the international banking system. These have all been, methods. These have been the weapons which have been used by Washington to try to bring Iran to its knees.
The Islamic Revolution not only transformed Iran into a democracy, but it also changed the world's political landscape. Iran is now a major player in the international arena. The country is also looked upon as a source of inspiration due to a range of policies, including its support for the Palestinian cause. But Iran's Islamic Revolution has not been to the West's liking. The question comes about why. Well, one possibility, Iran's domestic achievements in various fields, including nuclear and the military arena. Another strong possibility, Iran's refusal to be a vassal state of the U.S. That's in direct contrast to the path taken by some countries in the West Asia region.
One of the most overlooked aspects of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which ended Western domination of the country, is its global aspect. The Islamic Republic is now a bulwark of resistance in West Asia against imperialism and freedom-seeking nations which draw inspiration from Iran. This was most notably evident when the Islamic Awakening happened, which originated in Tunisia.
Well, certainly in the Muslim nations, from Morocco to Malaysia, if you like, there has been an impact of the Islamic Revolution on these countries, irrespective of whether they're majority Sunni countries or with substantial Shia populations. Because Imam Khomeini quite rightly at the outset said that this revolution is an Islamic revolution. It's not a Shia revolution. It's not an Iranian revolution. This is a revolution to resist the exploitation, the theft of resources of Muslim countries, and not only Muslim countries, but really anywhere that America goes, whether it's in South America or Far East, it's really stealing of resources and exploiting the people in those countries.
More than 42 years after the Islamic Revolution, the Iranians have now withdrawn their support with the resistance movements in the region for a moment. In Iraq and Syria, Iranians gave blood to protect people there from terrorists supported by the West and their regional allies. In Yemen, Iran has always played a constructive role. Tehran has encouraged the warring sides to engage in a political process to end the fighting.
If the revolution in Iran did not happen 42 years ago, then I think the whole region would have been completely dominated by Washington and its European allies.
All this began after Iran freed itself from the yoke of hegemonic powers, including the U.S., by toppling the Shah's regime. Iran is now a truly independent nation, and this independence was hard-won because Iranians gained it after going through years of suffering and hardship inflicted by their long-term adversaries.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has hailed the progress that the country has made following the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The revolution has directed us toward the right path of success and progress. It can lead us to the highest level of development, something that the nation wants.
Rouhani was speaking on the 42nd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. He said the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, relied on people to make the revolution successful. Rouhani said that asset is now threatened by the enemy who seeks to divide the Iranian nation. He said that such threat can be countered through resistance and unity, and that's what the Iranian people currently have. The Iranian president said that the country has been under intense pressure in the past several years due to the U.S. economic war. But now, he added, everyone admits that the U.S. pressure campaign has failed. Iran's foreign minister has warned the new U.S. administration that the window of opportunity for taking a new approach towards Tehran is closing. Mohammad Javad Zarif said the anti-Iran pressure campaign by the former U.S. administration has failed. He urged the new government in Washington to take lessons from that failed policy. Top Iranian diplomat said that his country would take new measures if the U.S. and Europe continue to fail to abide by their obligations under the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran is critical of the European signatories to the accord for their failure to make up for the U.S. withdrawal from the deal. The U.S. withdrew from the agreement in 2018 under former President Donald Trump, who reinstated sanctions on Iran. Iran's judiciary chief has called for punishing the perpetrators and masterminds behind the U.S. assassination of the top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and the senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks while meeting with the Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi in Baghdad. He said the U.S. violated Iraq's sovereignty and territorial integrity by murdering the two anti-terror commanders. Raisi hailed the Iraqi parliament for legislation that called for the expulsion of American troops from the country following the assassination of Soleimani and al-Mohandas. He said that a timetable for implementing the legislation is necessary. Al-Kadhimi, for his part, said that the Iraqi judicial body is following the assassination case. Two commanders were killed in a U.S. drone strike near Baghdad in January 2019. The Yemeni army says it has targeted Saudi Arabia's Abha International Airport in Asir province with drones. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the drones successfully hit the regime's warplanes, hangar, and airfields. He said the strike was carried out by domestically developed UAVs that were accurate in their target. Earlier, the Saudi state media reported that a civilian plane was engulfed in flames in an attack by Yemen's Hezbollah movement on the airport. The Yemeni army has in the past launched a series of such strikes against Saudi positions in response to the kingdom's war on the country. Sana'a says the attacks will continue until Riyadh stops its bloodshed. The U.S. is the biggest arms exporter to Saudi Arabia, but the new U.S. administration has recently announced an end to the military and diplomatic support for the kingdom's war on Yemen. The move was received as a sign that other countries would follow suit, but as a correspondent site Purazar reports, one country continues to put the arms industry above all else.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the U.K. weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters, and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Furiza, London.
Preliminary data shows that the Saudi Arabian economy contracted by 4.1% last year. The data has been provided by Saudi Arabia's General Authority for Statistics. They show that in the year 2020, the country's economy dwindled by 3.8% in the fourth quarter from the same period a year earlier. The losses have been blamed on the pandemic that forced strict restrictions in countries around the world. Lower crude prices and oil output cuts also made the Saudi economy shrink last year. The European Union has urged Israel to stop its continued settlement expansion on occupied Palestinian land. The EU said that the actions Israel has taken under its settlement policy are illegal under international law. The bloc named those actions as forced evictions and demolitions, among others. In a statement, the EU referred to large-scale demolitions taking place over the past months, despite the pandemic. It said only in recent days, Israel has demolished a total of 46 Palestinian structures in the northern Jordan Valley. The EU said some 60 Palestinians have been displaced as a result. It called for a halt to the demolitions. That's the latest in an international outcry against the Israeli practice. Myanmar anti-coup protesters have taken to the streets for a fifth day in a row, despite the military's ban on rallies. The protesters gathered in the capital, Naypyidaw, and the city of Yangon. They renewed calls for the release of the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. She has been in detention since the army seized power last week. Protests on Tuesday turned violent after Myanmar police used water cannons and tear gas to disperse the demonstrators in some locations. More than two dozen people were also arrested. The military staged a coup over alleged fraud in November's elections that Suu Kyi's party won by a landslide. Asian stocks have hit a record high as optimism has grown over global recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. MSCI's ex-Japan Asian shares index grew 0.8%. That was its highest level ever. China's CSI 300 index rose 1.3%. It was a 13-year high. The country's Shanghai Composite hit a 5-year high. Corporate earnings have been beating expectations in many places, including the U.S. and Japan. That's among factors fanning optimism over the global recovery from the pandemic. Hopes of a large U.S. fiscal stimulus and progress in vaccinations have contributed also. Infections and deaths from coronavirus keep rising in several countries in the Americas. Mexico on Tuesday reported more than 1,700 new fatalities in 24 hours. It also confirmed over 10,000 new COVID cases, bringing the country's overall tally to nearly 2 million. Brazil registered more than 51,000 new cases in the same period. It also reported almost 1,400 new deaths. Brazil is the second worst affected nation in the Americas, with more than 9.6 million total cases. The worst hit in the region is the U.S. Its total cases are above 27.1 million. Of them, nearly 470,000 have been fatal. The U.S. is also the hardest hit nation by the pandemic in the world. A member of the World Health Organization team investigating the pandemic's origins has hit back at the U.S. after it questioned the transparency of their probe. In a tweet, the WHO member said, "Don't rely on U.S. intelligence because it is disengaged and wrong on many aspects." The WHO team conducted its investigation in China and ended it Tuesday after 2 weeks. We concluded that there is no indication of the transmission of the COVID in the Chinese city of Wuhan before December 2019. That is when the first cases of the disease were reported there. The WHO team also eliminated a controversial theory that the virus had come from a Wuhan laboratory. Former U.S. President Donald Trump repeatedly referred to the theory and blamed China for the pandemic. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
First revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
In the limelight. Blinken, Vice President Joe Biden, along with his pick to lead the Pentagon, Lloyd Austin, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, were amongst the most prominent people in the Obama administration to have drafted their war strategy in Syria. This strategy entailed arming, training, and funding what they called moderate rebels, which turned out not only to fail when these forces engaged the likes of Daesh and others on the battlefield, but just so happened to align themselves with Al-Qaeda terrorists. We now present you an article written by Robert Inlakesh, a journalist, writer, and political analyst who has lived and reported from occupied West Bank. The piece is titled, Biden Continues Policies Which Put Kids in Cages in Syria. Please stay with us for more of Robert Inlakesh's article. U.S. President Joe Biden and his Secretary of State Antony Blinken backed policies towards Syria which saw innocent children separated from their families and placed in cages. But the worst part of it is that they have no quarrels with doing it again. Despite many having celebrated U.S. President Joe Biden's alleged policy position of eliminating the conditions which led to the separation of families and placing children in cages, the reality is that he still supports that very same wrong policy in Syria. Then Vice President Joe Biden, along with his pick to lead the Pentagon, Lloyd Austin, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, were among the most prominent people in the Obama administration to have drafted their war strategy in Syria. This strategy entailed arming, training, and funding what they called moderate rebels, which turned out not only to fail when these forces engaged the likes of Daesh and others on the battlefield, but just so happened to align themselves with Al-Qaeda terrorists. Joe Biden recently signed three separate executive orders in order to reform, not necessarily legislation, but policy, when it comes to the highly criticized actions of U.S. immigration detainment facilities. However, many don't consider that President Biden has presided over an administration who deported more refugees than Donald Trump, and also helped pave the way to the highly criticized actions under the Trump administration. Under the then Commander-in-Chief and President Barack Obama, the CIA funneled weapons and money to Takfiri extremist groups via a covert program known as Timber Sycamore. The primary stated aim of funding these groups in Syria was to supposedly install moderate forces in control in Syria, removing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad from power. Another part of this strategy was to allegedly combat the more radical groups like Daesh terrorists, which these groups rarely ever did. The United States, alongside the likes of Saudi Arabia, funded the terrorist group known as Jabhat al-Nusra or the al-Nusra Front. Jabhat al-Nusra was found to have not only encaged entire families, including children, of course, as far back as 2015, but was also using them to deter airstrikes on their positions in eastern Ghouta in Syria. This was whilst the Western mainstream press was presenting the terrorists as being the victims, effectively using their information against the Syrian government. In the 2016 WikiLeaks Hillary emails dump, we also learned that Hillary Clinton openly discussed Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime as having backed Daesh terrorists and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria. Not only this, but U.S.-backed factions had openly aligned themselves with Jabhat al-Nusra, or the al-Nusra Front, also al-Qaeda in Syria, and had committed horrific atrocities on camera. One such brutal act was committed by Harakat Nur ad-Din al-Zengi, which were backed by United States at the time and described as moderate rebels. This group beheaded a 10-year-old Palestinian boy, which they gleefully filmed. There are a plethora of crimes committed by US-backed factions and supposedly accidental airdroppings of weapons to Daesh, which we could take hours going over. But what is most key to understand is Joe Biden's role in these crimes. The reason Joe Biden has to be held to account for this now, and why it should be a huge issue of concern, is due to the fact that his entire administration is seeking a continuation of its occupation of Syrian lands. However, the current policy of today is not necessarily one of attempting to once again fund armed terrorist groups, although that can't be ruled out as a possibility, but rather to strangle the innocent people of Syria. For instance, Joe Biden's pick to head the Pentagon's West Asia desk, Dana Struhl, openly speaks about what objectives the US has in occupying northeastern Syria. The first one was the one-third of Syrian territory that was owned by the US military with its local partner. That one-third of Syria is the resource-rich. It's the economic powerhouse of Syria. So where the hydrocarbons are, which obviously is very much in the public debate in Washington these days, as well as the agricultural powerhouse. Additionally, alarming is that Secretary of State Antony Blinken indicated that not only would the US stay in Syria during his Senate confirmation hearing addresses, but also considered taking further action in Syria. Antony Blinken, being one of the men behind the catastrophic US government failure in Syria, which helped lead to the deaths of up to 500,000 people in the country, wants more pressure on the Syrian government, who won't reignite its economy with the help of its allies like Iran and Russia to aid its impoverished population. The biggest problem is that though the likes of the hardline Trump-era Caesar Act sanctions, the people of Syria now have little option left and suffer immensely, all due to US obsession with destroying their country and seizing its resource utilization. The sanctions placed upon Syria are not starving or hurting the government of Syria, but instead they're hurting the people of Syria, and this economic fallout is even spilling over into neighboring Lebanon. If the Biden administration really cared about refugees, then why continue to create them in the first place? Why not enable them to return home when many would love to go back home but can't due to US economic warfare? Why should a man who helped push millions of people from their homes, many of them dying in the process, be praised over some weak executive orders? From a Syrian refugee's perspective, how can you praise the man who planned the murder of your family and the destruction of your home simply for letting you live in his yard in the United States, in the dirt, in the refugee camps after the fact, yet making the decision to no longer separate you from your children during this process? Not only this, but it's clear from Antony Blinken having lied about Iran being months away from a nuclear bomb, echoing Israeli Lieutenant General Aviv Kochavi, that the US government is perhaps seeking to pursue Donald Trump's so-called failed maximum pressure campaign even further. If this campaign is continued, a big part of it is focused on Syria, and it seems that the Democrat establishment is picking up where it left off in the war-torn country. Children may or may not be in the cages along the US border anymore under Biden, but in Syria, every man, every woman, and every child lives in one big cage under Joe Biden's misguided and cruel policies.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Today and these days mark the anniversary of the victory of Islam after an era of darkness covering the entirety of the earth. These days are the days that the light of the Ahlul Bayt, the light of the Imam of our time, started to shine on the earth again through the revolution of the Ahlul Bayt, the Islamic revolution, and establishing in one part of the world, starting in that part of the world, the Islamic government, the government of the 12th Imam, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. How did the revolution happen? The revolution did not happen because there were armed groups. When Imam Khomeini started, he didn't say, go out and kill the police, or go out, put bombs here and there. He didn't do any of that. A year before the revolution, because of the work of the likes of Ayatollah Khamenei as a younger scholar in Mashhad, in other cities, there were a number of them, but the prominent one, the most effective one after Imam Khomeini was Ayatollah Khamenei, that unfortunately, if we had time, I would explain all the details of why we insist on him being from before the success of the revolution, being the prominent figure in the revolution, without getting his name out, without trying to show off that he... No. But it wasn't only him. There were others as well in different parts of the country, different cities. What was their work? Did they, again, supply arms? Did they say, go out and kill this, kill that, bomb here, bomb there? No. Hear what Imam Khomeini says, support it. They came out in support. The Islamic government has not attacked any location. They didn't initiate any war, any battle. That's what Islamic governments generally do. That's what the Prophet did. Initiate any enmity, any antagonism, any aggression. They weren't involved in any aggression. The wars inside the country by people that the CIA sent to try to take the Islamic Republic apart from Kurdistan, from Khuzestan, from Azerbaijan, from the area where the Turkmens are, from Sistan and Baluchistan, these areas, and Munafiqin, Mujahideen al-Khalq, as they called themselves, the killing, the mass killings, 17,000 people. Islamic government fighting them is fighting a foe, an enemy that has opened fire on you. They defended themselves. It's all defensive. Saddam was supported by the West and the East at the time. The USSR was with Saddam as well to fight against the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic fought back. It was defensive. The government responded there defensive. Israel occupied Lebanon. The Islamic Republic helped the Lebanese. They defended themselves, kicked Israel out. The Palestinians, Hamas, Jihad al-Islami, the other organizations that are there, their war is defensive. They're defending themselves. In Syria, the war has been defensive. In Iraq, it's been defensive. In Yemen, it's defensive. What the people did to overthrow the regime in Yemen was not to bring out weaponry. It's people coming out in support. It's the support of the people. The arms are used when they're attacked in defense. The people of the world. If it wasn't for the people of Yemen supporting this movement to overthrow The tyranny that was there, it would have never happened even if you had Houthis and others who believed in a different system. No, the people had to support. And the only reason why this is continuing is because the people of Yemen support. In Iraq, if it wasn't for the support of the people, the Americans would have installed another puppet in Iraq after Saddam. It was the support of the people that didn't allow the Americans to do that. Now the Americans want to stay and keep their base there. It's the Iraqi people that support the Americans being kicked out entirely. And that support is what's going to get them out. In Syria, similarly in Lebanon, in the world, and on a global scale, if this revolution is going to reach the revolution of the Imam of our time, which it will, definitely, that's a promise that we've been given. The path to it is this: people support, following the instructions from leadership. The numbers of people who do that increasing, their understanding increasing, their support increasing. And what will happen will be on a global scale. None of these powers will be able to stand against the people of the world. None of them. No Zionist can stand against the people of the world. And they have fragmented the people of the world in so many different ways, based on race, based on language, based on religion, based on so many different things, so that they can never get along with each other to overthrow that tyranny. All they need to do is this: unite under a just leadership and stand together. No military, but the military will come to them. The military of the United States will join the Imam of our time. It will. This will definitely happen. The generals were ordered, just like in the revolution in the Islamic Republic, the generals ordered the soldiers, the lower ranking commanders, to open fire against the people. Eventually, when one of the commands that Imam Khomeini gave, even before he went back to Iran, when he was still in France, the last stop he had before coming back to Iran, he said, I order all the soldiers to leave their military bases. People left. Commanders left. Those who stayed, when they were told to open fire against the people, they would turn around and shoot the commander who ordered that. The army surrendered. The generals had to surrender. They had no other choice. Why? Because the military joined the revolution. Military joined the revolution. There's a picture on the 19th of Bahman. 12th of Bahman is when Imam Khomeini came in. A week later, the most Americanized part of the army, the Air Force, that were many of them, if not all of them, were trained in Texas, in the United States of America. That's how America, their English, their exposure to American culture, the souvenirs they must have taken from the U.S., the last part of the military that they would think would fall to the revolution was the Air Force. Yet you have, there's a picture, the whole courtyard that they're visiting Imam Khomeini is filled with officers from the Air Force, all saluting Imam Khomeini. They joined the government, they joined the revolution, they joined the Islamic Republic.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Islamic Revolution, Preserver of Islamic Civilization. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the 42nd anniversary of the resounding victory of the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people over the oppressive Pahlavi regime. The day was the 11th of February 1979, but this year it falls on the 10th of February, since last year was a leap year. The victory of the Islamic Revolution put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Stay tuned, please. Many civilizations have emerged in different parts of the world throughout history. Each civilization has experienced four phases of emergence, flourishing, decline, and destruction. Civilizations in Iran, Mesopotamia, or Iraq, Greece, Egypt, China, etc., have rendered important services to human sciences and culture. But the Islamic civilization was more important, as it flourished in a short time and rendered great services to mankind. This civilization was shaped up on the basis of the Islamic teachings, and from the beginning, it persuaded Muslims to acquire various sciences from any source. Thus, a great number of scholars were trained in different scientific fields and presented their inventions and findings. Moreover, philosophers, poets, and artists left many outstanding works behind. Unfortunately, the Islamic civilization declined like a setting sun, and the era of scientific backwardness began in the Islamic lands as the dominance of colonialist powers started. The bedazzling triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 created hope in the growth of the Islamic thought and culture once more. Some of the features of the Islamic civilization have put Iran in the course of revival of the Islamic civilization. They include growth of spirituality, scientific progress, reliance on efficient domestic forces and thinkers, increase of national power and endeavor for unifying the Islamic world. Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, believes that the main path of this revolution will reach the modern civilization. After over four decades of the establishment of the Islamic Republic system, myriads of plots, problems, and enmities have failed to overthrow or divert this popular system from its main path. That's why the leader issued this highly important statement known as the second step phase of the Islamic Revolution in the 40th anniversary of this revolution. In that comprehensive statement, he has outlined the roadmap for the revolution as it enters the fifth decade of its life. He addressed the youth, saying, "The coming decades are your decades. It is you who should guard your revolution with experience and high motive, and take it ever closer to its great ideal, which is the creation of the modern Islamic civilization and preparedness for the sunrise of Imam Mahdi." In other words, the leader believes that the ultimate goal of the Islamic Revolution is to make preparations for the emergence of Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. One of the important features of every civilization is the culture that permeates in it. The Islamic civilization, unlike the Western material civilization, is based on spirituality, ethics, and belief in God. Such a civilization does not ignore and trample upon the rights of other nations once it gains power. It doesn't use sciences for illegitimate and inhumane purposes. The Islamic Revolution, as is evident from its name, is based on the progressive Islamic instructions and pursues the welfare and happiness of the individual and society, both in the material and spiritual dimensions. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "In the modern Islamic civilization, spirituality is beside materialism, and ethical ascension is beside progress in material life." The obvious characteristics of every civilization is flourishing of sciences and technologies. Since the very first year of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has made many progresses in different scientific and technological fields, despite the imposition of the eight-year war and unprecedented sanctions. With 10% growth in sciences, Iran ranks second in the world after China. It ranks fourth in nanotechnology and stands among the top nations in space technology, nuclear know-how, stem cells, production of medical equipment, and state-of-the-art military equipment, especially missiles and drones. For the past 42 years, the rate of illiteracy has decreased notably, and nearly 4 million students are studying in hundreds of universities and academic centers. In view of this, it is predicted that in the coming years, Iran will witness faster scientific growth. Usually, civilizations are weakened or perish due to external threats. For instance, the first Islamic civilization was harmed seriously by the Crusades of Europe on the west, which was almost concurrent with the Mongol invasion on the east. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as the color of the modern Islamic civilization, has been exposed to threats from the very beginning. In view of this, the Iranian military forces have been organized in a way that they are perfectly prepared for defending the country and the Islamic civilization.
The point to note is that the flourishing and spread of the modern Islamic civilization, unlike the Western civilization and many other civilizations in the past, is not based on conquest and military expedition. On the contrary, it is based on the lofty divine thought and culture which impacts and rules the hearts rather than bodies. This is the very reason for the widespread propaganda smear of the West against Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei says, "Islamic civilization based on a new thought, a new word, a new look at human issues and issues of mankind is the cure for the pains of mankind. It is a novel language that the hearts of the new human generations and deprived strata in various communities understand it." Well, dear listeners, on that note, we have to wrap up this program. May God help us to play our role in preparations for the formation of the Islamic civilization. Amen.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa maulana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Again, continuing with the Hadith of Ibn Hisham, or Hisham ibn Hakam, rather, from Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, we have reached the sixth, or section number six of this tradition, where the Imam alayhi salam is telling Hisham and comparing two important things. Again, with the use of the Holy Quran, that the Imam alayhi salam in this section is saying that there are two things that we as human beings possess or can possess. One is the intellect, which is God-given. The other is knowledge, which is also God-given if you actually look at it in its essence. But rather, knowledge is something that we acquire. And here the Imam is saying that these two aspects and these two qualities, and rather these two virtues, if you like truly look at it, go hand in hand. That a person who has intellect, who has the ability to comprehend, who has the ability to rationalize certain things, they are able to possess certain types of knowledge. And this is what the Imam says in this section of the tradition. So the Imam says that, O Hisham, use of the intellect goes hand in hand with knowledge. For Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said, we draw these comparisons for all people. What is meant by the comparison here is the comparison of polytheism to the web of a spider, that it is weak. And again, this verse is from Surah